Back to detail, if we may. How did detail get its name?
Right. When we landed on it, as far as we knew, it was unnamed. And we landed on the first Tuesday in Lent. So it was named Lent Island. And in fact, we moved into the hut on Easter Sunday, most of us. And we had our first meal in the hut on Easter Sunday. So it was appropriate sort of name to use for that building period. When we got settled in and doing things, now I cannot remember us having a copy of Sharko's book on base, but Eric Salmon, somehow or the other, got the information. Now whether he did it by radio with one of the other bases, because he served at several bases, but he found out that Sharko had actually named it, and he named it as Detail Islet, not Island. Over, and I think Islet is a correct name for it in many ways, because it is a cluster. Mm. And it was named after Monsieur Detail, who was a Frenchman in Punta Arenas, who helped sponsor his expedition. Oh. And Andreessen was the manager of the whaling ship in Deception.
Petro, last night, made the point, she said, it isn't Detail, it is Detail.
Yes.
And that is the correct pronunciation, but I'm afraid I will still call it Detail. I'm sure you will.
I think it's anglicised.
And the name of the hut, that was given a name.
Well, this is one of these fascinating ones. Bass has never had this, but I have it written quite clearly in my diary that Tom Murphy and Ron Miller carved a name board, Sharko Lodge, on the 23rd of December, 55. And I have checked with Ron Miller, and he remembers doing it, but doesn't know what happened to the name. And I checked with Dave Moore, and he knows that we named it. We certainly intended to call it that name. But none of us have ever, have no knowledge. I have no knowledge what happened to that name board.
It's something I never knew, anyway.
No, it was something that never came up in the second year, I don't think. I think if we'd put it on the hut, people would have known.
Yes.
If I can just go through that little bit when John went out, because they did exchange in the sort of the end of the first week of February, and it's just happened this morning that John and Ron Miller have sort of, well, Ron said, I don't think I've ever spoken to John. You know, John was coming in, Ron was going out. They obviously had, but very much in passing. But what happened then became critical and part of why the base was shut down. The scow brought in a load of coal, but on one of its trips bringing in a load of coal and other stores, it was squashed by a piece of ice and capsized and sunk. Now, I can't remember whether they got it up as such or whether we just used the motor lifeboat from then on. We certainly used the motor lifeboat for unloading the rest of the gear, but they lost something like 8 tons of coal. And the result was coal stores were very short at the end of year three, and there was no way could they bring coal in from the edge of the ice. And I think you recorded Dennis telling you about this. So there was no way they could get that in to refuel it, and the only option was to close the base without fuel. But we had that. But John and his party, the four of them, set off on the 1st of March. And you got back to us a few days before midwinter, when we went over and collected them from the refuge, when we had proved the ice was safe to travel. Angus and Jim got down to Base Wise Refuge just before midwinter, and they got back to us about 3 or 4 days after midwinter.
You both served under Angus Erskine.
Yes.
What kind of chap was he, John?
A very able leader. He was an excellent base leader. I imagine partly from the experience he'd had in the north. Yes, he was very enthusiastic, wasn't he, John?
I found him just such a great guy. He gave a lot of confidence the whole time.
Yeah.
We had so much confidence in what we were doing from based on his experience. Because a bit later in the year, again, we had this situation. Yes. When John and I, we came in, John came back, And shortly after that, they did a bit starting off in sort of late August, middle of August. They started going off and getting the survey stations built up, cairns built, and things ready for the measurements of a big new baseline, which we did. And then they all shot off in different directions, and John and I were left together on base to run it. And we ran it for 28 days, shift on, shift off.
That was doing MET night and day.
Yes.
And, because we were doing it every 3 hours when every people were IGY.
All the whole time. So, so we were sort of shift on, feeding each other and whatever. So, and we still talked to each other, so it was a good relationship. But then Dennis went off with Ozzie Connacky, the radio op, and they went up to go to Darbal Bay, and they had been gone only a few days. We had a big gale, and the ice broke up behind them. Then we got into the situation. We still had groups whizzing around in all direction, but Jim Madell and Bill
Bill McDowell
set off to go up onto the plateau, following the route that John and co had done in the autumn, which was the route that Ron Miller and co had found the first year. I don't know what happened. I've never found out what happened. According to Henry Wyatt's notes, which I've got, they went up and went along the top and everything else, but they couldn't have done from the time. I know what they did, how many days, but they came back in and nothing was ever said about what had happened. But the result was they obviously talked to Jim, to Angus, and Angus and Jim would have talked together. But it finished up then that Angus and I were decided, and it was Angus' decision, that we would become a rescue party and go up onto the plateau, north along the plateau, find a way down a glacier, out to the Darbal Islands and recover them. And that's what we did.
Yes, when the ice first broke up, we had a message from Secfids saying prepare the dinghy to go up to effect rescue or whatever.
And we had a 12-foot pram dinghy.
And that, with the katabatic winds piling into the sea around there, it would have been, theirs was a hazardous journey going over to you. And to go up into Darbal Bay would have been, you know, absolutely impossible. But
yes, the sort of local knowledge came into it there. So Angus and I went, and we had the most incredible journey. Really was absolutely wonderful. We went up the glacier, and almost at the point where John and Dennis had been stuck in the snow hole, we had a layout there, temperatures down, certainly way down, probably minus 30, but with a 40 knot wind, which gives you a wind chill of about minus 90. And then we got through that, got up on the plateau, and romped along the plateau as far as what was then called the West Borch Glacier, now known as the Erskine. And we looked down this, and Angus had seen some of the aerial photos from the days when he was at Deception. And he looked down and reckoned it, and we could see the Darbal Islands in front of us, and it looked as though it would go, so we went for it. And we had a tremendous run down that glacier. We had a long layup in amongst a maze of crevasses till we could see what we were doing. But once we were through that, we were down until we hit what was mist or fog actually, the top of it. And we stopped in this fog. And as we stopped there, all the dogs, which normally would just lie straight down, were all sitting up, ears pricked up, and obviously excited by something. And Angus and I picketed the dogs, and we started to probe our way down what seemed a very steep slope. Suddenly found ourselves down on the sea ice with the seals in front of us. And so from there, we ran down the next day, having got a seal and fed the dogs with seal. We went down on the ice, went a few miles along, found what is now called Phantom Point. We called it Ghost Point because it loomed up out of the mist. And then we went out the Darbal Islands and found Ozzie and Dennis sitting in their tent. I'm not sure what they were waiting for. They didn't have enough rations to last. But they wouldn't eat pemmican. They were eating seal all the time there. Mm.
I just reflecting back to that time when that sea ice went out, we had obviously no radio contact, even though Ozzy was a wireless operator. Those days were so different. And to have that feeling that literally they were lost, because as far as we could see, the sea ice had broken right up to the Biscay Islands. And so your journey up there, you didn't know until you were looking down into Darwa Bay that the ice was still there, that they were indeed there. Times have changed so much, there was no contact, was there?
No contact.
You found them alive and well and well fed.
We found them well, we brought them back, we did astro fixes to fix various bits. We climbed the north branch of the Erskine Glacier coming out. I describe it, I know in my diary, as sledge mountaineering with dogs, because I actually had a mountaineering type belay on to the front of a dog team at one point to hold them, to just keep them in position, it was so steep. But we got out, and we came along the plateau. Angus and I went on and climbed Castle Peak where Ozzy and Dennis, but while we were up on that plateau, Ozzy got one of these 68 sets. Officially range is 5 miles, but with an aerial which he worked out all the harmonics on the aerial, being a good radio op, and joined all the wires appropriately stuck on ski poles, and he worked Port Stanley with this set from the top of the plateau on Morse key and told them what was doing. So one of those. Ozzy and Dennis came down to the refuge hut to find the ice was broken up, no way they could get back. Angus and I did Castle Peak and a few other little bits, then came back to the Murphy Glacier, and John said, you could have got down it in a day. We came down it in a day. We just raced down there at a gallop most of the time. Most impressive, beautiful. And we were stuck then at the refuge, and that was November, and the ship got to us in February. So we were in the garden shed for most of that time.
Is this the Orford Cliff we're talking about?
The Orford Cliff Rescue. Refuge.
And you ran out of food?
We had food. We were running tight by the time the ship got to us. We were just starting to run a bit tight. We had food, dog food, for only about another 10 days.
You see, there's these near misses, for want of a better phrase.
Yeah.
Was there ever any analysis afterwards about what went wrong and what to be done about it? I mean, Angus Erskine was actually one of the few base leaders to leave notes for next year's team. So I can't imagine he didn't hold some sort of inquest.
Oh, Angus certainly did it, and Angus put in a recommendation they closed the base, as it was too dangerous.
Right. Did you agree with that?
I suppose I do, in a way. At that time, it was a difficult situation. I'm just reflecting while they were at the refuge. My question to them when they came back, did you have any problem with the waves that you can get there? Because there was one night one day, Dennis and I were in... we'd been out 2 or 3 days before when the sea ice had formed. And I had taken soundings around the refuge while the ice was there. And then, of course, it all broke up. We knew we were going to have to wait a lot longer to get back to base. But during the day, just after the ice broke up, we were in the refuge, and there was a tremendous crash. And I went to the door, opened the door, and I was looking down at the area that I had sounded the day or two before through the ice, and I could see the bottom and another wave coming in. And I said, Dennis, hold on. And we had another great crash as the wave hit us. But we were all right. The dogs were all obviously very wet. And after that, we took all our stuff up to the top and camped above the refuge, because obviously it was a freak event. Probably an iceberg turning turtle or calving. Some people said, well, it could have been activity from the Chilean earthquakes or something. I don't know, but it was a worrying time, and I didn't feel comfortable ever again in that refuge. But you had no experience with that at all?
We had one where we actually had a wave as a result of it was something capsizing, berg capsizing, where the wave came up onto the rocks on which the hut was sitting, and one of the poor dogs got extremely wet and did not like having a bath from the sea, but so we moved her onto a different spot. But that was the only time we had it there.
Was detail a particularly exposed base then, where you were more open to the ocean than others?
I think it was... If you look at the normal construction, geologically, historically, of fields being cut, they tend to have a deep bit and then rise at the mouth of them to a set of shallows. And I think this was it. We had Lierd and Andreessen on the two side, and this hump, which was probably, many would have said, was a moraine, but in fact, in our case, it was a bit volcanic anyway, making this shallow patch right in the entrance of the field. But with the katabatic winds there funneling down, it funneled down, especially the Roo side. It came down much more strongly on the Roo side than it did over on the Andreessen side.
Did the hut vibrate?
It sung. The guying wire sung on occasions.
Yeah.
Certainly, I know Ray Cooper, who was our diesel mech in year one, who was helping out on Met nights. He got blown away one night. I got blown away from the Met screen. And at that time, we had 20 dogs just to the south of the Met screen. Oh. And I landed in amongst the dogs and sort of crawled round till I recognised a dog and I knew where it was on the dog span and could then work my way back to crawl back to the hut.
John Smith?
Well, I remember, I think I was on Cook at the time, and Henry was doing experiments with the dogs. And what was the best food for them, and he was doing the trial where one set of dogs were having this new dog food called Nutricum. I think that he also had a team with pemmican, and then one being fed on seal meat. So he would then go out and collect the feces, and be able to work out what was the most efficient sort of food. On this particular day, it was blowing a howler again, and Henry said, I'm just going out to sort out the dogs. And he didn't come back in for some time. And when he came back in, it was an apparition, because he was sort of all coated in ice. And what he had done, there was a penguin approaching one of the spans with the dogs, and of course that would interfere with his experiment with dog feeding. And so he chased the penguin. And he chased the penguin, which went over the cliff, and Henry followed over the cliff into the water. And very luckily got back. But did you see him?
Yeah, I've got this noted on my diary, and I've also got Henry's note of it happening as well. But the thing that was lucky was Henry was a whitewater canoeist before he came south. And so he had canoed slaloms and canoe rolling. So he was used to being into water suddenly, which I think was a great help for him. He knew straight away he was in water, fine, out, get out. And there was a crack in the cliff at that point, which he got into and scrambled up.
But Henry made his own canoe down there.
Yes.
And on one occasion, he was telling us about the way he could roll a canoe. So we thought, well, Henry, please do that for us. And we went up onto the ice cliff and looked down at Henry down below. And Henry, okay. And so Henry rolled the canoe dutifully and took a photograph. Didn't get that one, Henry. Do you mind? I think it was the third time he said, that's enough. But, he was a character.
Tell me a bit more about the dogs you were working with. What was the team called? Because you had quite a few at first, and some of them moved to Hope Bay, is that right?
Well, we took 20... Yeah. Originally, we had 20 dogs from Hope Bay.
Oh, from Hope Bay. Okay.
From Hope Bay, we had 20 dogs. And to that, we bred on. So on the first year, they were just known. There was one team, which were boys, and a scraggy team, which was Hedley Wright's team. By the time Angus got there, we had got quite a lot more dogs bred, and we had got some teams. And they were called at that time the boys and the girls. Well, the girls' name developed and became the ladies, and is one of the names of the teams commemorated on the memorial. And the other one in year three became...
Counties?
There were the counties, which Jim Madel ran, with beds and hearts and in it. And the other one, I can't...
I'm not quite sure what county Jakey would come under with the counties team, but never mind.
You had odd ones like that, but at least there was a name that came up as the county.
So who was Bodger?
There were three brothers from Hope Bay. Bodger, Fluke and Rufus. Daily Mail cartoon, back page of the Daily Mail for many, many years. And these three dogs. And Rufus was a big white, like a sheep, real shaggy coated husky, weighed 140 pounds, and he was the lead dog of that group. And he was lost in a crevasse accident with Tom and Ron and Mike Orford when they were going up the Murphy Glacier the first time. They went down a crevasse, they got him out, they were trying to get the other dogs out, and he got loose and fell down without any restraint, and that was it. And then Bodger became the lead dog. And what a superb dog.
Terrible dog.
Absolutely.
Why so, John?
Well, just it had so much character. I mean, John knows more about it than me, but certainly we sledged, obviously, with Bodger up in our time there. But he was just a magnificent dog. And but the tales you have to tell of him sensing the crevasse, for example.
When we were going down the Erskine Glacier, we were going down, and it was pretty poor, very poor visibility, really. And we were trying to work out what to do. And Bodger was going down quite happily. And suddenly he jinked right and then left and jumped. And we went across a very wide open crack. And as soon as he got to the other side and his team was behind him, he just lay down. And he stayed there. And we looked at each other, however, having crossed this very wide gate and sort of very carefully got the ice chisel to start probing around and found there was another crevasse just in front of him. So we pegged the dogs, and in fact we camped on an isolated block for that time. But then again, when we were doing some filming on the local survey out from the refuge in November, we were running along the top out towards, I think, Alpha Nunatak and one of those bits, the Neb Bluff. And we were going there, and we got amongst, again, one or two crevasses, and Bodger just laid down. And you look at each other and think, why has he stopped? And you go forward, and there you're seeing this slight depression in the ground of a snow bridge. Not a very good snow bridge at that time of year, and a bit of prodding, and you suddenly realise, thank you for stopping, Bodger. Yeah.
Yes, I can remember Alpha and putting my feet through on quite a few occasions there. But of course, the dogs will be pulling the sledge, and you just should be across it. But
do you ever come to any conclusions as to how these dogs were doing this? How do the dogs know what was ever
beyond me?
I think in some ways it becomes their instinct. I think they're lower to the ground. They get a different aspect on it. But you see, you had the situation of the three guys being killed in the tractor accident at Halley, using that latest radar to find things like that. It doesn't always work, and certainly Bodger went down crevasses as well. But there were occasions where it did work.
Tell me about Ozzy.
Ozzy and I went down on the ship together. When we got down, Ozzy was quite a character. He was much older than most of the people who were coming down. Been a ship's officer, a mate on board a ship during the war, and then his eyesight tray gave trouble, and he became a radio op. But
He's on the Andes.
We went down on the Andes. But he had been in Merchant Navy. He had been torpedoed three times during the war, so he had seen a lot. But as a result, he tended to hit the bottle fairly hard at times. But the classic one was just before midwinter. We just got John and Dennis back, I think, from the refuge, or we got them back the next day. It was just about that time. But Bill McDowell, decided to do pilot balloon. So he and I filled a balloon in the workshop where we filled them, carried it through the hut. As we went through, the balloon popped. So we went back, filled another one. We came through. Ozzie was on cook in the kitchen, saw us coming through, thought it was midwinter decorations, and stubbed it with his cigarette, in which there was a very large explosion. The windows got blown open. Ozzie lost his eyebrows, hair, had his hand singed rather badly. And he said, I thought you were making decorations.
You only had to fill a party balloon after that. He started to shake.
What was his proper name? His real name?
Ozzie Connacky.
Ozzie Connacky.
Yeah.
Is Ozzie short for Oswald or Australia?
Well, it was an Oswald originally, but he was always Ozzie.
Yeah.
There was no doubt about it. When we were going down, he got extremely drunk a couple of times on the ship, and there was a strong feeling he should be shipped back home. But I had been with him then for about 3 weeks, and I said, this guy's got a lot going for him as well. And I said, you know, I think he come onto base, alcohol won't be so freely available. Although he always seemed to find enough.
He did, and there was a problem because he smoked a lot as well. And
yes.
So you really had to be very wary, and you really kept an eye open because he could nod off.
With a cigarette.
It would be very dangerous.
The other character in your team seems to be John Thorne. You've got a nose about him.
Quite a character. He and Tom Murphy did not hit it off at all. He explained to Tom in no uncertain ways that how Tom ought to be doing his job. And when we came back from having been stranded out on Rue Island, it had reached the point where if Tom suggested or said anything, he would not take any notice of it. He would not talk to Tom. And communication was done by Tom sending a signal to Stanley, who sent a signal to who answered with a signal to Stanley, which came back to Tom. The only person he was talking to on base was me, and I had been with him 6 weeks, over six weeks, and we could still talk to each other.
Dennis was very good.
Lovely guy.
Absolutely a lovely person and very committed to his profession. And he's just carried on in the same way, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
But going back to Ozzie very briefly, in spite of the problems, you know, the surveillance that had to be there with Ozzie,
yes.
He was a very able wireless operator. And of course, he taught all of us how to use the set on base. And to be able to be fairly competent in doing radio skeds, which was, you know, a very commendable thing. But that was the nature of the setup in those days, that there was that interdependence, which was something
of great
value. We
were totally
dependent
on each other, so we all backed each other the whole time.
Well,
I think the only other person with a sort of thing there was Frank Oliver.
And yes, he was a bit of an exception.
And he was a loner in so many ways. And I couldn't understand why he stayed down. I cannot understand why he stayed. Okay, he got what he wanted. He went out sledging a lot in the third year. But he was just not interested in his job as a diesel mech. And things like when he was on cook, he would cook a meal, and it was pretty awful.
Oh.
Serve it on the table and walk out. So we had scrambled egg parties every night at about midnight. All of us, one of us would get to the stove and start cooking something.
I mean, there's always some sadness, I've no doubt, in relationships, but he had bagpipes. He did try it on us in the hut, but that wasn't acceptable. But he used to go out to the dogs, and he'd play it to the dogs, and you'd get the dogs participating, howling away. You know, it was quite something to witness. But Frank was certainly a little bit different.
One gets the impression from what you're saying that there was a degree of friction in detail which perhaps wasn't present at other bases.
I think there was far less friction in detail than what I saw. When I landed at Admiralty Bay, we did not see any of the base members for the first 24 hours. And we'd been going backwards and forwards from the ship, the post and all stuff. They just didn't come. They didn't come down and talk to
That's
us.
That's rare.
And it was a bit like that at Argentine. When we went in there, they didn't come out, which was rare. And I see in this, and I thought the people who, I know it was a small base, a five-man base at Admiralty Bay at that time, I think they had a fairly tough time together. I think they were so much on top of each other, five of them in this rather grotty hut. I think they were having a hard time.
And if you're not doing field work, you're not out, then...
What a difference that makes, yes. Yes, Henry puts notes about people suffering. And I know in my diary I said, everyone's got basitis, or we've all been bitten by the tsetse fly and got sleeping sickness, you know, and nobody got up. We were bored, we couldn't get on, couldn't get out to do things. And you run out of doing all the little jobs.
So it was the spectacular nature of detail and the variety of work and...
Oh, I think so.
A lot of purpose there.
Yeah.
A lot was achieved. All right. A lot of time, you know, reflects on it, the lying up on journeys, because it at times it would be, you know, 7 days, as I say, on top there in the tent. You can't do anything. Mm. You're just waiting for the relief of the wind to abate and to get on with it. But it was a very good base in so many ways.
Well, was it inevitable that detail has such a short shelf life?
I think it was. By the end of year three, because they'd had such superb sea ice in year three, the geology was totally covered by Dennis. The surveying, all the main points were in, although they put in some more and they did some longer runs linking with other bases. But I think the main work that you could do in that area was done. All you could do is put a sort of automatic weather station on there if you wanted it. But with the upgrading around everywhere, because Adelaide was going in, you were covering that area in a different way. And I think detail then really was surplus to requirement.
Were either of you there when it was closed down?
When it was?
Closed?
No, Dennis was the only one at that time of us.
But you've been back, John Smith, haven't you? The year 2000, you made a pilgrimage back to detail.
That was quite something, yes, on the Millennium Cruise. And after visiting quite a few of the bases, we didn't have any idea that it was getting to W. And it was absolutely magical. We were going along by Lied there, and suddenly from the bridge, John Smith, John Tate, come to the bridge. And they took us in the Zodiacs. They took us in. We went through the pack ice back to the base. And it was quite something to go ashore there. And yes, we didn't have long though, because the wind was getting up, and the northerly set of the wind with the pack ice that was there, obviously they read it as well as I did. I knew that what had happened in the past, that would pack very quickly together, and it would have been difficult, and the Ilova would have had to wait some while to get us back. But it was magical to go in there. Sorry that the others couldn't get in there, but it was something of great substance.
I was lucky when we went down in 2007. It was absolutely clear, the landing area at that time, but I couldn't recognise the site. What I knew as a series of these snow domes and rising to the beacon, it was mud and rock with patches of snow. Mm. There was so little snow compared to what I had seen over the years before. But we went in, and the people on the ship by then knew that I have been there. And so they gave me the honour of being the first in on the first boat and the first person to land, to be greeted by a fur seal who refused to move out of the way. So I had quite a problem to dodge around him. And I then talked a bit about the hut before we went in, went into the hut, and I'd only got down talking, I think we got to about the bedroom door, or the bunk room door, and I just got there, and there was a shout for me, John, there is a letter for you. And it was a letter from John Killingbeck. He'd been there 2 days before with a cruise ship and left me a letter. They hadn't intended to go there, but it was open, so they went. But I spent 2.5 hours there, back on the base, in the hut, and looking at it. Absolute magical time warp. Magical. And just remembering so much of what had happened.
Was the guitar still there?
I don't know. There were bits I can't remember. I can remember a pair of long johns hanging at the side. I don't know whose they were, but there was a long johns and an old army greatcoat was there. But there were skis on racks and ski boots on the shelf, things that I'd helped put up. But my cupboard, which in the past always used to have stacks of boxes of chocolate in the bottom of it, was completely filled with bottles of salad cream, where someone had tidied up or changed the system. So, things like that, Jay.
And looking, sorry.
I was upset in some ways by the amount that had been trashed by various people. But I have actually, since then, met the skipper of a yacht who had been in there and spent a half an hour or so chatting with him, and seen other people. And the numbers who now go to detail are just unbelievable.
John Smith?
And going into the kitchen and seeing the stove there and seeing the water tank, which we used to go out and cut blocks of snow and put them into that, and looking at the floor, which we used to keep very clean and polished in the summertime, all broken up as a sort of jigsaw puzzle. It's, you know, all the linoleum had broken up. In the winter, if you tried to clean it and put any water on it, you had a skating rink. Temperature in the hut, At head height, you're probably in about getting on for, I suppose, 70 or 80 degrees, and your floor temperature about minus something or other would be
minus. Many occasions, yes.
But
there are plans to upgrade things, aren't there?
Well, preserve, I think. I think that's really the way. It will be preserve the fabric of the building by repairing the rubber roiding on the roof, replacing broken windows and doorways that are not so good. It's got one addition since we've originally erected, which is the snow porch on the north door, which I put on because we had problems in the sort of drift times of drift with getting lots of drift in the corridor. So I put a snow porch on there at the beginning of the second year. But other than that, it is virtually original. It's as we did it, but so much has been removed by persons unknown. Some of it by persons we do know, places of people have taken stuff to the right places. But if I go back a bit further, you said about problems and problems we decide. A lot of the food stuff that we were given in year one was ex-Royal Marine stuff that had been sent down about 5 years before, had not been used by the Marines, had been left stacked on in the open in Port Stanley, and was then shipped to us as new. And lots of the time on sledging rations, the box looked absolutely perfect when you opened it, but your whole 12 days, 10 days ration, two men, would be rotten on biscuits. The tins of butter were quite often rancid.
They're absolutely rancid, yeah.
And this caused a problem. And also on some of the general base supplies, a lot of stuff, especially the dried milk powder and that, we were way, way below what we should have had as a result of that stock. And I did a very big report on it for FIDS, and they received it extremely well and made efforts to replace. But obviously the loss of the coal was never reported, and that was never replaced as a result.
And the second year, I had to do, in fact, the food, didn't
you I? You did the food, and you took over from me.
And that was not easy because of, although you had the right sort of the complement you should have had, you didn't have it all, and it was difficult. And basically, on any base, you had 2 years' supply. But we certainly found wanting, weren't we?
Oh, yeah. Yes, there was some wanting.
But we did have local fare, of course. We did have the occasional seal, and we certainly had plenty of penguin eggs and penguins, if we wanted the penguins.
You had a lot more eggs, of course, at Deception than we ever had down at
Did you ever use the, what do they call the stuff to preserve the eggs?
No. Isinglass, no.
Isinglass, that's
Isinglass,
the one,
yeah. No. No, we never kept penguin eggs.
It's been a real pleasure, John. And John, thank you very much indeed for listening. We must stop.